This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Welcome to The People Speak on BBS Radio Network. Today is Tuesday, August 23rd. I am Sophia Ray, your host this week. Tune in to The People Speak every Tuesday for interview-style talk radio with various hosts and guests. Participate during the show by calling in questions for a guest toll-free in the USA and in Canada at 1-888-429-5471. Calls will be taken during the second half of the show. We are a 60-minute live show, and for more information on The People Speak, log on to bbsradio.com/The People Speak. Our guest tonight is Bishop John Shelby Spong, a lifetime Christian who is dedicated to bringing in a fresh new look at Christianity. For many decades, Bishop Spong has brought a new set of eyes to the world of Christianity and into a more literal sense. Tonight, Bishop Spong is here to tell about his new book release, Biblical Literalism, Gentile Heresy. It is my honor to welcome Mr. John Shelby Spong on The People Speak. Hello, Bishop.
Hello, Sophia. So glad to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. I don't know where to begin, but you've been in this business a lot longer than I have. So can you, do you have any guidelines or any rules you want to set with me?
Well, what I try to do in this book is to put the Bible into the context of history, which very few people seem to understand. The Jesus of history lived, according to our best estimates, between 4 BCE and 30 of this common era. First gospel was not written until 72 of this common era, and the last gospel was written around 100. So between the death of Jesus and the publication of the first gospel, there is a minimum of 42 years and a maximum of 70 years. In the ancient world, that would be 2 to 3 generations. This means that everything we know about Jesus had to float in some form of oral transmission for 42 to 70 years before it was written down. And the question I ask is, where did it float? And it's very obvious to me that it floated only in the synagogue. The reason for that is that when the Jesus story emerges in the Gospel of Mark, the Hebrew scriptures have been wrapped around him. The Hebrew liturgical synagogue year has been the organizing principle of the story. That's why the crucifixion is told against the Passover. That was a liturgical connection, not an historical connection. The Jewish messianic ideas of the past, which would be well known to a Jewish audience, were articulated, and Jesus' life was turned in such a way as to portray him as fulfilling all of them. And the Jewish way of telling stories about heroes of the past and translating those stories to heroes of the present is clear in the gospel tradition. And all of those things could not have happened anywhere except in the synagogue. So the gospels are synagogue products. A third date that my audience might need to be aware of is that the Christian movement did not separate from the synagogue until about the year 88. Of this common era, by which time at least Matthew and Mark were written. And so they are products of the synagogue, which I will argue, I do argue in the book, means that you've got to read those books as Jewish books with Jewish eyes, accepting a Jewish background. And if you don't do that, or if you don't know how to do that, then it's almost inevitable that you literalize those stories, which are never meant to be literalized, and reproduce the biblical fundamentalism that we know today, which drives more people away from Christianity than attracts it to them. So that's the thesis, and I really enjoyed working on it. It's sort of a lifetime theme for me.
Indeed. You know, you're bringing up the synagogue a lot, and what was the reason for the split?
Well, the reason for the split came because Jerusalem had been destroyed by the Roman army in the year 70. That's at least 2 years before the first gospel was written. There was enormous tension in the synagogue as they became the objects of great persecution by the Roman forces following the defeat of the Jewish army in the years 70 and 73. The war finally ended in a place called Masada in 73. And the ability of the synagogue to tolerate deviation within it became less and less. It always happens in times of stress. And so the officials of the synagogue became more and more what we today would call right-wing or fundamentalistic. And they were under the control of the what might be called the Orthodox Party of Judaism. And they'd been able to tolerate these deviants, is what they thought of them, these followers of Jesus who were Jewish, I need to remind our readers. They were able to tolerate them as a minority presence within the synagogue until the very life of the synagogue was threatened. In 70, the Jewish people lost their capital, their nation, their temple, their priesthood, and all they had left was their sacred story, their scriptures. And so they began to talk about these scriptures as being complete and literally accurate and fundamentalistic, and nothing more needs to be added, which made it harder and harder for the followers of Jesus to remain in that community, because they were saying that we believe God has acted in a new way in the person of Jesus, and we need to incorporate Jesus into the ongoing history of the Jewish people. That had happened many times before. That's how the prophets got added. Isaiah and Jeremiah and Hosea and Amos and Micah were all late additions to the tradition, with new prophetic people arose and their insights were incorporated into the ongoing and living Jewish story. But it became harder and harder to incorporate somebody who was different when they were under distress for their very lives, and where everything about Judaism looked like it was falling apart. And so they tolerated it from about 70, when Jerusalem fell and the temple was destroyed, until about 88. And they got to the place where they simply couldn't stretch far enough to incorporate the followers of Jesus. And so they revised their prayer book and anathematized all the things that the followers of Jesus stood for, and that precipitated the split. Then from 88, when that split occurred, until about 150 of this common era, the Christian church became more and more Gentile church. And by 150, it was about 100% a Gentile church. And these Gentile people had no idea of the Jewish scriptures. They had no appreciation for Jewish liturgy. They had no appreciation for the Jewish storytelling tradition or Jewish messianic thinking. And so they began to read these Jewish stories as if they were literal historical occasions, as if the Gospels were biographies of Jesus instead of portraits painted by Jewish worshipers to incorporate Jesus into the ongoing Jewish story. And biblical fundamentalism gets born in what I call the Gentile heresy of misunderstanding. And today, you know, we live with the tragedy of biblical fundamentalism. I grew up in the South. And my church taught me that segregation was the will of God, that men were created superior to women, that it was okay to hate other religions, and especially the Jews, and that homosexuals were either mentally sick or morally depraved. And they quoted a literal Bible to prove all of those things to be true. And I spent a great deal of my life trying to get out from under the prejudicial teaching that I received as a member of the Christian church as a child growing up in the Bible Belt of the South. I find today that fundamentalism, is still rampant in parts of our society, is so destructive to most people. There's an organization in New York City called Fundamentalist Anonymous, where people who have come out of fundamentalism find support communities to live with the trauma and the guilt that they feel because of the way they've been twisted by fundamentalistic religion. We see it in the political campaign today. I don't want to be identified with what is called the Christian vote in America because it seems to be pro-war, pro-execution, anti-women, and anti-homosexual, and I see nothing Christ-like about any of those stands.
In your book, you use the Gospel of Matthew, and you have really torn back a lot of the layers. Would you explain the connection of Matthew into the synagogue?
Well, I'll try. It's a little bit cumbersome to do verbally. But the first thing you do is you recognize that they've attached the crucifixion story to the Passover. The Passover was a liturgical celebration of the Jewish people to celebrate their exodus from Egypt. And what happened is they began to identify Jesus with the new Paschal Lamb. And before you know it, the crucifixion story had been drawn into the orbit of the Passover. I don't think it happened then. I think there's a lot of biblical evidence that I probably don't have time to report or to talk about that indicates that the crucifixion took place in the fall of the year. At least one piece of that evidence is that about a week before the crucifixion, we have the story of Palm Sunday, when the people are said to have waved leafy branches to welcome Jesus into Jerusalem. The only trouble is that a week before Passover would be late March, and there are no leaves in Palestine or in the Holy Land at that moment to wave. But Mark puts these leaves in there because the story, I think, was originally in the fall. Then Mark adds another story, and Matthew picks up both of these. Mark adds another story about Jesus on the second day after he had come into Jerusalem, walking back to Jerusalem, and this day the story of the cleansing of the temple is going to be told. And on the way, the gospel says Jesus was hungry and saw a fig tree in the distance, and he went to the fig tree to get some figs to eat. And then the gospel writer reminds you that there are no figs to eat on a fig tree in late March. And Jesus is quite upset about not finding any figs there, and he lays a curse on this fig tree, which is a very un-Jesus-like sort of act. And the fig tree shrivels up and dies. Well, that might make sense with you if you talk about that in the fall of the year, but it makes absolutely no sense to portray Jesus as laying a curse on a fig tree that doesn't produce any figs in the spring. I tell people that'd be like laying a curse on me because I can't get pregnant. There's some things you just can't do, some things nature just can't handle. And so this again points to the fact that the original setting was in the fall of the year. But once that is set, then you can go around, but you have to be familiar with the Jewish holidays. The next holiday after Passover, if you follow that route, would be 50 days later. It was called Pentecost because that means 50. It's also called Shavuot. And it celebrated for the Jews the occasion where Moses was supposed to have received the law from God on Mount Sinai. And it was a 24-hour celebration. And the Jewish people wrote the 119th Psalm, which is the longest psalm in the Psalter, to be used at that 24-hour celebration. It had to be a long psalm. It's 176 verses because it had to go through 8 3-hour segments of a 24-hour vigil. And that's the place where Matthew places the Sermon on the Mount, which portrays Jesus as the new Moses standing on a new mountain giving a new interpretation of the Torah, the Ten Commandments. And it portrays Jesus in a very interesting way based upon Psalm 199, which was the Jewish psalm written for Shavuot. That psalm opens with an 8-verse introduction. 2 of its verses begin with the word blessed. So Matthew opens the Sermon on the Mount with an 8-verse introduction, and all 8 of those verses open with the word blessed. He's clearly been influenced by Psalm 119. Then you keep going until you get to maybe late September, early October, and you come to the Jewish New Year celebration called Rosh Hashanah. And Rosh Hashanah was the time when the Jews had liturgies of expectation about the Messiah. And they would look for the Messiah to come, and when the Messiah didn't come, they would say, well, next year in Jerusalem. And John the Baptist is the familiar figure that's associated with Rosh Hashanah, and if you trace the Gospels, you find that John the Baptist becomes a star in that part of the Gospel where they're celebrating Rosh Hashanah. Then Yom Kippur is next, and that was the day of penitence. That was also a day of atonement. That was also a 24-hour vigil. And penitence, the day of atonement, was expressed in the stories of Jesus going into that which was unclean and coming out of it and not being made unclean in the process. A good illustration of that is the story of the call of Levi Matthew, who is a Jewish man supposedly in the service of the Roman government. So it'd be a Jewish man associating with the oppressive Gentiles. That would make him unclean. And Jesus goes into the receipt of custom and calls him out into discipleship. That's a super Yom Kippur story. And the next thing that happens in the Jewish year is called Sukkot, or the Harvest Festival. It was sort of Jewish Thanksgiving. And it was an 8-day celebration. And if in the Gospels at exactly that point you have all sorts of harvest parables like the sower who went out to sow and the parable of the wheat and the tares and the parable of the mustard seed growing, and all of these are clearly designed to have Jesus' stories be told at that particular time of the of the Jewish liturgical year. And the last of their great celebrations would be what we call Hanukkah, but what they call dedication, which celebrated the return of the light of God to the Temple of Jerusalem at the time of the Maccabees. But by the time the Gospels are written, the temple has been destroyed, so there is no temple for the light of God to be restored to. And so the Gospel writers portray Jesus as the new temple, that is, the new meeting place between God and human life. And they have the story of the light of God coming upon Jesus, and that's the story that we call the Transfiguration, where Jesus was made translucent with the light of God. And once you know the scheme, once you know the background, then you can see how the followers of Jesus, who were all Jews, related Jesus' material to each of the holidays of the traditional liturgical year of the synagogue. But if you don't know that about the synagogue, you'll never be able to see these references. And the Christian church went through what I would call a Gentile captivity from about 150 until the latter years of the 20th century, when the only people that read the Gospels, the only people that interpreted the Gospels, the only people that wrote commentaries on the Gospels were Gentiles who were ignorant of these Jewish background materials, and so they could not possibly interpret the story from its proper Jewish perspective. And that's where we had Christianity sink into what I would call biblical fundamentalism.
Jesus seems to be the popular character here. In Matthew, let's just go back to Matthew just a little bit here, because you say Matthew is not the Word of God, or is that correct?
I'd say none of the Gospels are the Word of God in the sense that God dictated them. You have portraits in the Middle Ages of, I remember one by an artist named Caravaggio, that shows an angel guiding Matthew's hand as he writes the words, so that he'll only write the words of God. Well, Matthew copied Mark. Matthew copied about 90% of Mark right into his gospel, and he felt free to change Mark, to edit Mark, to delete from Mark, to add things to Mark. So Matthew didn't believe that Mark had written the Word of God, and he didn't believe he was writing the Word of God. That's again, another fundamentalist idea that's been imposed upon the Scriptures. If you were Jewish, you would know that the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000 in the wilderness was a Moses story, retelling the story of Moses praying and God sending bread, manna, in the wilderness to feed the starving Israelites. You'd know the story of Jesus walking on the water. It was designed to show that Jesus had the same power over water that Moses had over water when he split the Red Sea. And I could go on and on and on with those stories that make perfect sense in a Jewish background. But once you take them out of the background and literalize them, they don't make any sense at all. The only place I hear Jesus walking on the water stories being told today is when somebody's telling me a very bad golf joke. And you sort of live with that stuff. But it's biblically ignorant. It's biblically illiterate. In the latter part of the 20th century, we began to see on both the Jewish side and the Christian side a movement back toward an original unity between the two great religious traditions. And I rejoice in that. I've been very much shaped by the people who began to bring those two things together.
You speak of these miraculous events, these magical stories in the Bible. There's a saying that the Bible, all roads lead to the occult. Any opinions?
All roads lead to what? All roads lead to what?
Lead to the occult.
I can't hear you.
Am I seeing some feedback here?
I just didn't understand what you said. All roads lead to what?
To the occult.
Okay, I just didn't hear the word.
Yes.
I think that's true. All four Gospels devote from 25% to 40% of each of the four Gospels to the last week of Jesus' life, which is dominated by the story of the crucifixion. It's clear that that was the primary emphasis of the Gospel writers. And so, you know, that's obvious. It's almost as if the Gospels are prologues to the last week of Jesus' life.
Let's talk about Jesus a little bit. You don't believe that Jesus was a miraculous, immaculate birth. Do you believe that Jesus was an individual, and did Jesus actually take in Christ? And as from my point of view, I see Christ more in the avatar spirit.
Yeah. Well, it's that's difficult to catalog that in a very brief way. But let me say, in regard to the virgin birth, and the word immaculate is not used, and that immaculate refers to a Roman Catholic doctrine in the 19th century about the birth of the mother of Jesus, not about the birth of Jesus, the Immaculate Conception. But the virgin birth story does not appear in the Christian narrative until the 9th decade. Paul didn't know anything about the virgin birth. All he says about Jesus' origins are that he was born of a woman. I submit that that's not terribly unusual. And Mark didn't know anything. The first gospel written about 72 didn't know anything about the virgin birth. He begins his story with Jesus as a perfectly normal adult male who comes to be baptized by John the Baptist. And it's only in the act of baptism, Mark says, that the heavens opened and the Spirit of God descended upon Jesus and fulfilled him. And that's when God pronounces him the Son of God. The virgin birth story is introduced in Matthew's gospel. For the first time, nobody's ever heard of this story before. It's repeated, but in a very different form in Luke's gospel about a decade later. And then it disappears from the fourth gospel. There is no virgin birth story in the fourth gospel. It begins with the story of Jesus being part of who God is at the foundation of the universe. And it even, in two places, one in chapter 1 and one in chapter 6, refers to Jesus as the son of Joseph without any qualifications at all. So if you take the major writers of the New Testament, it would be two of them never heard, and there are five in number. Two of them have never heard of the virgin birth. Two of them give you the myth of the virgin birth, and one of them dismisses it, probably because he considered it not an adequate way to explain the power of Jesus. So there's nothing about the virgin birth that was meant to be literalized. Even Matthew, who introduces the story, bases it on a text from Isaiah and says that this story fulfills the text. The text is Isaiah 7:14, which we have translated to read, "Behold, a virgin will conceive and bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel." But that's not what Isaiah says. Isaiah says, "Behold, a woman is with child." That's very different. Not a virgin will conceive, but a woman is with child. And it refers to a moment in Jewish history when the city of Jerusalem is being surrounded by the armies of the Syrians and the northern kingdom. And Isaiah says to, I think his name was Amaziah, who was the king, who was out looking at his battlements, that you don't need to worry. God will give you a sign that your kingdom will continue. And the sign was that a woman is with child. Well, that's not the virgin birth. If it were literal, would have happened 800 years later. That would hardly have helped Amaziah in the time of the siege of his city by the kingdoms of Syria and the northern kingdom. So that, you know, it makes absolutely no sense to literalize that story once you read the narrative in the Bible. No, I don't think that there ever was a virgin birth. I don't think virgins can conceive. I think that was a way the early Christians were trying to say, we have met something in Jesus that we don't believe that human life by itself could ever have produced. And they chose this rather Mediterranean way of saying it. There are no virgin births in the Hebrew Scriptures. The only kind of miraculous birth you have in the Hebrew Scriptures are the birth to a postmenopausal woman, like the birth of Sarah, the wife of Abraham, who's supposed to have conceived at age 90, and the birth where barrenness is overcome, a woman unable to conceive suddenly is allowed to conceive, and that would be in the story of Hannah, the mother of Samuel, and in the story of the unnamed woman, who is the mother of Samson. Both of those, all of those would be in the Old Testament, but the idea of a virgin birth is a very Greek Mediterranean idea. There were lots of virgin births in the Mediterranean world, all the way from Romulus and Remus to Alexander the Great had made claims that they were sons of a divinity instead of just being a normal human being. And Matthew has adopted that, and I think he adopted that because there were some rumors floating around, some charges being made, that because nobody talked about the father of Jesus, that Jesus might have been an illegitimate child. And so Matthew tries to defend him against that claim, and he does it in two ways. One is to tell the story of the virgin birth based upon a misreading of a text in Isaiah. And the other is the way Matthew introduces the story of the virgin birth, which again, most people never see, because he introduces it with 17 of the most boring verses you'll ever find in the Bible, the who begat whom verses. But hidden in those 17 verses, Matthew tells us that Jesus had four ancestral mothers in that line. It's rare indeed to include a woman in a genealogical account, because at that point people didn't know that women produced an egg cell. They didn't know that women were anything more than incubators for the life of the male. And so a woman didn't count. That's part of the negativity toward women, was that they were not seen to be as co-creators with human life. We didn't discover the egg cell until about the 18th century. And virgin births make no sense once you've discovered that women have an egg cell, because then Jesus could not have been fully human and fully divine. He would have been half human and half divine, which would make Jesus more like a mermaid or a centaur than he would like what we Christians claim he is, the fullness of human life in which we have experienced the presence of the Holy God, which is the essence of the divine claim that we later turned into the doctrine of the incarnation.
While we're speaking about women right now, Mary was considerably younger than Joseph.
There's no evidence for that, but that's the tradition.
There's not a thing
in the New Testament that says anything about the ages of either one of them.
But what I want to get at here is that Christians look at Muslims or Muhammad marrying a six-year-old and judge them and bash them. What would you say to those Christians who are unaware of that those same stories are in their Christian Bible?
Well, you don't ever overestimate the ignorance of a lot of religious people of all traditions. The probability is that Mary was a teenager. The probability is that Joseph, well, I don't know that Joseph ever existed, to be honest. Joseph doesn't enter the Christian story until Matthew. There's not any reference to Joseph at all anywhere until the ninth decade. And only when Matthew introduces the virgin birth story does he create the character of Joseph. And the fascinating thing about that Joseph is that if you were Jewish, you would know that he's patterned that Joseph around Joseph the patriarch in the book of Genesis, Joseph the coat of many colors person. There are three things you know about Joseph from Matthew's story. One is he has a father named Jacob. Two is God only speaks to him in dreams. And three is his role in salvation history is to save the Christ child from death by taking him down to Egypt. If you go back and read the Joseph story from the book of Genesis, chapters 37 to 50, you'll find that Joseph, there are also three things you learn about him. One is he's got a father named Joseph. Two is he becomes the interpreter of dreams. He's identified with dreams. He's even called a dreamer. He rides into political power in Egypt as the interpreter of the dreams of the Pharaoh. And his role in salvation history is to save the people of the covenant from death by starvation, by taking them down to Egypt. It is an identical story, and Matthew is clearly not writing history. He's clearly interpreting Jesus against the background of the Jewish scriptures. I don't believe that Joseph ever existed. I think he's a literary character, sort of like Harry Potter or Sherlock Holmes. That's an author created in order to tell his story. And once you begin to read the gospel from that point of view, it becomes really much different and much more profound. Joseph also disappears as soon as the birth story is over. He never appears in any gospel and in an adult story about Jesus. So he's only present for the birth narrative. And the birth narrative creates a vacancy in Jewish society, because you cannot have a pregnant woman without a male protector in that society. So Joseph is introduced as the male protector and the male legitimatizer of Jesus. Also, if you were Jewish, you would know that the Jewish nation had been divided primarily into two major groups. One was the tribe of Judah, where Jerusalem was located, and that's where we get the word Jew. It comes from Judah. The other part of the nation was basically the tribes of Joseph, and they were the northern kingdom. And they split away from the southern kingdom after the reign of King Solomon. And one of the messianic tasks of the Messiah in Jewish history was to bind together the Joseph tribes with the Judah tribe, and so the Jewish nation would become a unified nation again. And Matthew does that by making Jesus the son of David through the genealogy, and then introducing a man named Joseph as the male protector. And he keeps this Joseph. He brings Joseph and Judah together. The first act of the Messiah in his infancy is to bind together the tribes of Joseph and Judah and to make the Jewish nation one people once again. Every Jew would understand that. It's the Gentiles who are not familiar with that bit of Jewish background that would never think to look at this as symbolic, and that's the way I think Matthew meant it to be looked at and meant it to be read and understood.
This is Sophia Ray and the People Speak and BBS Network. We are here with Bishop Jack Spong. I hope you don't mind me calling you Jack.
Not at all.
We got to take this into a break. Some good stuff here. Stay tuned. Don't go nowhere. We will be back in a few minutes.
I will be right here. Thank you, Sophie.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
And we are back on The People Speak. I am Sophia Ray, your host. We are here with Jack Spong. Welcome back, Jack. We have a question for the guest. Do you mind taking that question?
Not at all.
All right. Sarah in Tennessee wants to know if John has read any of the Sumerian texts and knows many of the same stories in the OT. Are the same as such in the Sumerian text? If so, how does he explain this?
I didn't quite understand. How do I explain what?
Let's see. The Sumerian text knows many of the same stories in the OT.
Oh. Yeah.
Are the same as in the Sumerian text? How does he explain?
Well, I think that most all religious stories have a common background and theme. There's a flood story, for example, in almost every ancient religious tradition. I suspect that originated from the memory of the ice ages when they began to decline. There was an abundant flooding in various parts of the world, and it was thought to be sort of worldwide by those people. I just recently was reading a book on Mesopotamian history, and I came to an ancient king of the Assyrians, whose name was Sargon, and Sargon seems to have had a birth story in which he was put into a reed basket with pitch, filling it in and placed on a river just exactly the way Moses was. And so there are a lot of connections that go on. The Quran, of course, is written 600 years after the Christian story, and it incorporates a whole lot of the Christian story in it simply because it was familiar with it. But I think you'll find a connection. In the course of my life, I've had the privilege of doing dialogues with Buddhists in China and Hindus in India, and having Islamic scholars attend my clergy conference and teach us about Islam, and also did an 8-week dialogue with a wonderful rabbi in Richmond, Virginia named Jack Daniel Spiro. And in all of these interchanges with other faith traditions, What I found was that the questions that we tried to answer in every religious system were pretty much the same. They're about the meaning of life and about how you cope with life's exigencies. But the way we answer them, those concerns and those questions, are always acculturated. That is, the Western world has a different understanding of the value of human life from the Eastern world, primarily because we never had to face the population numbers of, say, China and India. And so the individual is valued more in the West and less in the East. So you begin to get individual ideas like individual resurrection in the West and sinking into the sea of God in the East. But I think that these are the places where the disagreement takes place. It's not in the human questions that we ask. Every religious system is designed to give an answer to the questions of life, existence, and meaning. And I think they need to all be respected because it's an attempt to make sense out of this thing called life that we all share.
There's this word in the Bible that I kind of struggled with for a very long time. And it wasn't until I read the Sumerian text myself that I learned more about this word. And this word is sin.
Yeah.
In the ancient text, that word connotes to a ancient god. But in the Bible, it's much different. Can you relate to this at all?
Yeah, there is a difference. The Greek word that we use for sin is harmatia, which tries to translate a Hebrew word, which I probably don't pronounce correctly, called he-amen. But both of them come out of the experience of an archer aiming at his bow and arrow at a target and missing the mark. So sin means not to be what you were created to be. That's its essential deep meaning. But in the Christian world, in the 4th century, we began to talk about human life being created perfect. That was the way we literalized the first chapter of Genesis. And then because our ancient ancestors, Adam and Eve, disobeyed God and ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we began to develop the idea that human life had fallen into sin, which meant some chronic debilitation of our humanity from which we could not extricate ourselves. And against that background, we began to tell the Jesus story of how God intervened, poured God's divine self into a human life in order to rescue us from this fall, this sinfulness that we could not rescue us from, which we could not rescue ourselves. And we've been telling the Jesus story from the 4th century on pretty much in those categories. I think those categories are dead. We're post-Darwinian people, and we know that there was no such thing as a perfect creation. We started our journey into life as a single cell about 3.8 billion years ago, and we have evolved from a single cell into complexity and then finally into consciousness and finally into self-consciousness. And the problem with human life is not that we are created perfect and fell into sin. The problem with human life is that we're still evolving. We have not yet achieved our perfection. And I think we've got to turn the whole Jesus story around from rescuing the fallen to empowering the human to become more deeply and fully human. And when we do that, I think there'll be a renaissance of the Christian faith. But we will have moved into a different understanding of Christianity by that time. We will not be trapped into the old literalistic patterns.
Right. We have a caller in the line. And caller, come on through and state your name and where you're from and your question.
I had a question if I could ask.
Okay.
And that is, Bishop, how do other Christian clergy view you? Do they consider you... especially with your stance on homosexuality and reinterpretation of the Bible, you must be hated fiercely.
Well, I am in certain circles, and I regard that as a badge of honor. I've had 16 death threats in my life. None of them have come from an atheist or a Buddhist. They've all come from Bible-quoting, true-believing Christians who seem not to have read that part of the Bible that says, "Thou shalt not kill." But the fact is that there's an enormous difference between what I would call academic Christianity, that is the Christianity of the scholars in the theological seminaries of the world, with which I'm in almost total agreement, and the kind of Christianity that gets proclaimed in a pulpit in an average church on Sunday morning. And even that is changing. I teach regularly in my career. Before I became a bishop, I served churches in Lynchburg, Virginia, which was made famous by Jerry Falwell. and in Richmond, Virginia, in a church that was called the Cathedral of the Confederacy. And I taught an adult class every Sunday morning for an hour before our church service began. It was by far the most popular thing that we did, and great crowds of people came to that. So my sense is that people are ready to hear this, because I don't know anybody that still believes, when they think about it, that virgin births are literally true, or that miracles literally happened, or that God can cause one side of a war to win over another side. That sort of stuff has been rampant in Christianity, but I don't know anybody, when they think about it, that believes it. I'm also a member of the Jesus Seminar, which is about 300 biblical scholars that meet regularly and discuss all these issues. And far from being controversial, I'm not controversial at all. I'm probably conservative in that body, and I find that rather interesting. I don't lack for support, and the homosexual battle is frankly over. That was a pretty alive battle when we engaged it for the first time in the 80s, but that's over today. The Supreme Court has made marriage a possibility for gay and lesbian people as well as for straight people, and even the Republican Party, which was greatly opposed to homosexuality a couple of years ago, no longer wants to debate this issue because they know they're on the wrong side of that issue, and they're really glad the Supreme Court took it off the table.
Jack, you were a huge force into bringing in the gay rights movement into the church, correct?
I hope so.
You know, do you have any regrets, or is there anything that you wish you would have done, or any new changes or opinions since that time, which was
I think every person lives in their own generation. I grew up in the South, and we had to fight the civil rights battles for the dignity and humanity of people of color, and that was a very exciting time. I'm the father of four daughters, and we had to fight the battle for equality for women in the life of the society and in the life of the church, and that battle's over as far as my church is concerned. We have about half of our clergy are now women. About a third of our clergy are now, of our bishops are now women. And we had a great battle over welcoming gay and lesbian people into the life of the church. But today, there's an absolute welcome in almost all parts of the Episcopal Church. We have two openly gay bishops who live openly with their partners. When I retired from the Diocese of Newark as a bishop, I had 35 out of the closet gay and lesbian clergy serving quite openly. 31 of them lived with their partners in a publicly acknowledged relationship. And they were absolutely fantastic clergy. So these battles are over. I'm not on the forefront anymore since I'm retired, and I hope somebody's picking up whatever the next issue is and calling the church to be faithful to its witness in regard to that issue. Climate change may be the primary moral issue of our generation. But I'm really not alone. I've written, I think it's 26 books. They've sold just under 2 million copies. There's an awful lot of people in this world who have been touched by the sort of things I've developed in the course of my life. And I feel a very deep sense of accomplishment. I think the Christian church is different and better today because people like me have been in it.
We have a caller in line 3. Lee, come on in.
Okay.
Hello, Jack. We've been listening to you. You were talking about people having dreams and equating this to talking with God. It seems I've heard somewhere along the line, amongst the many stories of God, that these people that put themselves in these positions of power use some sort of psilocybin. They had a different name for it back in them times, to help enhance them, their ability to communicate with God. Do you know anything about this?
Not much. There may be occasions in some religious traditions where they would take some substance that actually had some mind-expanding drug qualities about it, like peyote, and begin to think that they were having religious experiences. But I'm not an expert on that, and I wouldn't want to comment on that, because I haven't done that, and I don't know anybody that has, and I'd like to at least have some firsthand knowledge of that before I try to proceed. I do think that there is a level of consciousness that people with deep spiritual senses can access and develop. And I think that's why you have religious geniuses that appear not often. I mean, if you look at the great religious leaders of the world, you might put Moses and Jesus and Muhammad, and we don't even speak often of whoever founded Hinduism and Buddhism, because we don't have the Buddha is a little bit better known than the founder of Hinduism. But these all were giants who discerned a dimension of life that other people weren't conversant with. And it turned out that there was more a level of consciousness that they had achieved. I think probably that's what marked the great saints and the great mystics of the ages, and you find them in all religious traditions. So I would not want to talk about that much because I don't think I understand it, and I certainly don't claim to be part of it. But I do think that there is a dimension of breaking through into a new level of consciousness that takes place in certain religious traditions and leads people to a spiritual vision that would not be common to most people.
If you like tonight's show and you guys want to know more about Jack Shelby Spong, you can log into John Shelby Spong, SPONG.com. And sign up for his website. You can find his many books on Amazon, at your local libraries, Barnes & Nobles, your local bookstores. Take a look for them. Jack, you know, there's one thing I did want to, you know, kind of touch up on you with, and it was the birth date of Jesus. Why is this such a mystery? And, you know, it's often said they don't know, it's speculation. But for something tells me that somebody knows something.
Well, I don't know. The Gospels didn't get written until 42 years after his death. The idea that they might have remembered the date of his birth, and no birth stories entered the tradition until the 9th decade. All we know is that Jesus was born. I suspect he was born in Nazareth, not in Bethlehem. There was a great Jewish expectation that the Messiah had to be born in David's hometown, which was Bethlehem. And so both Matthew and Luke sort of turn the story to have him born in Bethlehem, but it takes a lot of doing. If you read Matthew, you'll discover that Mary and Joseph and the Christ child live in a house in Bethlehem, and then they have to flee Bethlehem to get rid of the wrath of Herod, and they wind up in Nazareth. If you read Luke, you'll discover that Mary and Joseph lived in Nazareth in Galilee, which is about 94 miles from Bethlehem, and that they had to go up to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem, to be taxed, to be enrolled by order of the Caesar, because they were of the house and lineage of David. So that they don't agree on many details. Matthew has Jesus fleeing into Egypt with Joseph and Mary to avoid Herod, and Luke has Jesus being circumcised on the 8th day in Jerusalem and presented in the temple on the 40th day in Jerusalem, and then leisurely going back to Nazareth where he grows up. The two things we know is that Jesus is identified with the city of Nazareth in Galilee. He's called over and over again Jesus of Nazareth and Jesus the Galilean. And we also know that messianic thinking required that the Messiah be born in David's birthplace. He had to be heir to the throne of David. And so there would be a natural tradition that would cause them to develop mythologies about Jesus' birth in the city of David. But I don't think much of history is in there. I think he lived for about 30 years. Our best calculations would say that he died at age 34. That he was crucified at age 34. And we get to those dates by checking secular records and discovering when Pontius Pilate actually was the procurator of Judea, which is between 26 and 36. And then we have some ways that we can narrow that scope down a little bit to between 28 and 32. I think that's probably as close as we can get with any authoritative data. So you split the difference and you say he was crucified in 30. And you know you're not more than 2 years off in any direction. But yeah, there are all sorts of things. I don't think there's any question about the fact that Jesus was a figure of history. I think the great question is, how was he interpreted? What was the source of his power? And you find that being debated throughout the gospel narratives. Most of the miracle stories, however, that are attributed to Jesus are either Moses stories or Joshua stories magnified and retold about Jesus, or they're Elijah stories and Elisha stories magnified and retold about Jesus. Or they're part of what we call the signs of the kingdom. Somebody went to the prophet Isaiah, who was an 8th century figure, and said, how will we know when the kingdom of God is dawning? And Isaiah says, this is Isaiah chapter 35, Isaiah says, you will know when water flows in the desert, when the crocuses begin to bloom, and when human wholeness breaks out, by which he means, and he says this, the blind will see and the deaf will hear and the lame will leap and the mute will sing. So they began to attribute these miraculous events to Jesus because they believed he was the Messiah, and so they put the signs of the Messiah breaking in into the life of Jesus. I think that's where most of the miracle stories come from. They're Moses stories, Elijah stories, or kingdom signs that Jesus is supposed to have acted on.
Is there any indication that probably Jesus traveled to India and studied?
Not at all. That's a familiar story. And it's because people see a dimension of consciousness in him that they don't think they could have been produced in what we call the Holy Land. They see Eastern influences. But, you know, people don't quite understand how difficult it was to travel to India in that
one
day.
Moment? Not
it took
for
10, 12 moment, years, and he didn't live long enough to do many trips to India.
Well, India is the oldest culture on the world. It's older than Christianity.
Oh, yeah, it's old enough for Jesus to. I'm saying if you travel from Nazareth to India, it would take so many years that one round trip would take a great chunk of your life. They didn't have jet planes in those days or even trains. You travel by donkey or by foot. And so you're talking about a huge. It took Marco Polo much later than the time of Jesus. Practically his lifetime to make that trip and come back. So I just think that's a lot of pious nonsense. Novel writers like to dream about that so they can have some theme to write a novel about, but I haven't got much time for that sort of theory.
No worries. We're coming to the end of the show right now as we speak. Are you going to end up writing another book at all?
I'm always writing another book. That's a disease. I'm working on the last stages of it, of the manuscript, and it's called Charting a New Reformation, and it's about all the symbols that Christians use that need to be radically rethought in a new reformation. I make the point that in the reformation took place in the 16th century, nothing really changed except the authority claims. We used the same Bible, said the same creeds, worshipped in more or less the same liturgical form, but you and I live on the other side of Galileo, on the other side of Isaac Newton, on the other side of Charles Darwin, Sigmund Freud, Albert Einstein, Stephen Hawking. And the way we perceive reality has changed dramatically. And so we can't say the same old words that we said in the 4th century because they no longer make sense to modern men and women. So I think we've got to recast the Jesus story in the light of the knowledge available to us in the 21st century. And so that's what I'm trying to do. It will not be exhaustive, but it will be a pointer in the direction that I think the Christian creeds have got to go to make Christianity a viable, believable system in the 21st century. I'm having a wonderful time writing it.
I had a wonderful time reading your recent book. I'm looking forward to reading more.
Thank you. The new one won't be out until 2018, so you got a while to wait.
Okay, and I'm sure there's loads of other people as well excited for these books to come out. It was a great show with you, Bishop.
I really loved being with you.
I never have enough time on here. And
well, we'll do it again. Anytime, give us a call.
Any last words for our audience before we go?
No, let me just say that my way of understanding Christianity is that it's a call to live fully, to love wastefully, and to be all that each of us is called to be. And if we can put the Christian faith into that sign of context, I think there's an enormous number of people in this world that would be excited to listen to the Christian story once again.
On that note, time is up for tonight. Big thanks to our guest, Bishop John Shelby Spong. Find more information at bishop@johnshelbyspong.com. Thanks for our listeners and our engineer Don Newsom at BBS Radio and our producer Mike. Be part of the change for humanity and our planet. Let us unite through love and light. Good night, everyone.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering. And land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.